for argument is Sornberger versus Knoxville. Mr. Kanovitz.
May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, I'd like to start with the undisputed fact in this case that the police extracted a false confession from Teresa Sornberger. And the issue in the court below was whether a jury was going to be allowed to decide if that false confession was the result of coercion or if it came about by some other manner.
I want to ask you this. What is your best evidence that officers Pesci and
Clegg
can be held liable for Teresa Sornberger's arrest, either directly or as bystanders? Because to me, at any rate, that seems to be your weakest claim.
Okay. Well, there's three points in time on Teresa's Fourth Amendment claim where the Fourth Amendment was violated. There's the moment that Shepard crosses the threshold. There is the point in time where we believe a seizure occurred by a show of authority before a probable cause was developed. And then there's the formal arrest based upon this false confession. PC and Clegg's liability lay on the first of those Fourth Amendment violations. And that is because they participated in the planning meeting where, after the search warrant was executed, this group of officers, including PC, who was the ranking person from his law force, and Clegg, who was the ranking person from his law force, decided that approximately five officers would go in and execute this search warrant. And keep in mind, the search warrant was for a computer. Mouse pad, if there is one, keyboard, box, monitor, and take it out of the house. That was the scope of the search warrant. And what was decided is, while that was going on, if Teresa Sornberger was discovered in the house, PC would enter the house, attempt to get her to come with him to the police station, and if in either event, try to question her. And that was a violation of the warrant requirement that was done almost at the direction of these two people. So there is, they knew not only that there was a chance that a constitutional violation would take place, they were there they helped plan it. So that's more than enough under a failure to intervene theory of liability for what happened here to hold them liable.
Now, the defendants claim that although Dugan retracted his statement that the robber looked like Scott Sornberger, Pesci didn't hear that retraction. So, I mean, would you concede that there's no evidence that he heard the retraction?
I wouldn't, Your Honor. I mean, the facts in the record are that PC is watching the tape in a room in the bank. And outside of the room are gathered a couple of bank employees, including Mr. Dugan, and the tape plays with serial angles of this robbery. And so let's assume it was the first angle, or at least it was an earlier angle. They're watching it. Dugan, from the outside, remarks, that looks like Scott Sornberger. Then the tape changes. The angle changes, and you watch the whole event again from a different angle. And watching that angle, Dugan says, no, that doesn't look like anything like Scott Sornberger. So unless PC got up and walked out while this tape was playing, which there's no evidence of that, the inference is that he did hear it. Because he was able to hear it the first time Mr. Dugan made a remark. There's no reason to believe, for purposes of summary judgment, drawing the emphasis in our favor, he wouldn't have heard it the second time. And more than that, I don't know that Mr. Dugan's retraction of that statement figures very heavily into the probable cause analysis, because I don't think his making of the first statement figures very heavily into the probable cause analysis, and here's why.
But even if the defendants didn't have probable cause, what effect are we supposed to give to qualified immunity in a case like this. So the Supreme Court has said there is qualified immunity even in the probable cause situation. Mm-hmm. So how does that...
Qualified immunity is an available defense where there's a allegation that there was arrest without probable cause. And the analysis, at least at the summary judgment stage, is taking the facts as a jury might find them to be. It, was the law clear enough that there was not probable cause for this arrest? And our position is certainly the law was clear enough, because what a jury should be doing in this situation is it should be looking, on the one hand, if you trace the evidence as it developed on what the probable cause was.
But suppose a jury looked at the pictures in the appendix and it says they do look alike, look like twins or something like that. But nevertheless, you know, we think there should have been more investigation before an arrest. But then they or someone, or the judge, or someone has to make a judgment. Could a reasonable police officer have thought he had probable cause, although he did not? Mm-hmm. Someone has to make that judgment, right?
Right, and that is a question of law that would be going to the judge. And the issue is looking at the totality of the circumstances. And, you know, the law on probable cause is clear. You look at all of the facts in the totality. You also look at the quality of the evidence as well as its quantity. You have a description from the teller. And that's the first thing that PC learns is, you know...
But, you know, these eyewitness they're always cockeyed because, you know, people are frightened and so on. But the pictures, just look at the pictures. They do look a lot alike.
Well, there is a resemblance
really
in the pictures.
It's quite striking in some of the pictures.
The degree of resemblance is ultimately a question of fact for the jury. And the question is it the sufficient degree of resemblance to justify distrusting the only eyewitness account? And it's true that eyewitness accounts can be...
But that's the probable cause issue. My question, I'm puzzled by this, is the role of qualified immunity in a probable cause a setting. So it seems to me the issue is, could a reasonable policeman have thought he had probable cause, although he didn't have probable cause? Because the pictures looked alike and the Sornbergers were known to have financial trouble. Doesn't add up to much, right? May well not be probable cause, but couldn't a police officer think he had probable cause?
The degree of resemblance is a factual question.
You're not answering my question.
Maybe I'm not comprehending it. There's a legal question in terms of the judge looking at, is the state of the case law enough to put the officer on notice that this was an arrest without probable cause? In making that decision at the summary judgment stage, the judge has to take the facts as a jury might find them and say, if the jury found them that way, was the law sufficient to put this police officer on notice? And the point that I'm trying to get at is the degree of resemblance is a fact question. And a jury may find, you know, there are differences here that if you want to stop and look at them, and that some of the officers noticed. The pictures themselves are black and white. They are of a lower quality than the in-color, live, high-definition view that the teller had. And the teller also told you there's facial hair. If you look at those pictures, they either show someone who's clean-shaven or they're not good enough to tell.
The mustache is very faint in color pictures. Let me ask you a different question. Why is Galesburg named as a defendant?
Galesburg is a Monell defendant as well as an indemnity defendant for the actions of PC. For the actions of Shepard Riley.
But how can you show Monell liability for Galesburg?
Well, there was some stunning evidence below on the... Monell wasn't challenged on the summary judgment. It was just whether there was underlying constitutional violation. But there's some stunning evidence. What we did is we were able to find lots of citizens of that area who came in and said, you know, the police have used similar threats to get me to do something, quote-unquote, voluntary. You know, a threat about DCFS to
is
get me to...
Is this all in the record?
It is in the record. There was a motion to strike an expert report that discussed this very issue, which I believe the judge ruled in our favor on. So it is in the record. It was not a summary judgment point because the defendant's main focus for summary judgment was no underlying constitutional violation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Want to save your time?
Yes, please.
Ms. Knight?
Good morning. Elizabeth Knightford, Chief PC of Knoxville. Knoxville is no longer in the case, as the court questioned, though Galesburg is a defendant.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Galesburg is still a defendant, but Knoxville is not. So just
but
Chief
who
PC.
Who isn't?
The city of Knoxville. I represent Chief PC for the city, and he's with the city of Knoxville. So I represent him in his individual capacity. And Knoxville is no longer in the case.
Okay, I understand.
And Mr. Kelly, who's also here, he represents Knoxville and the two officers from, I'm sorry, represents Galesburg and the two officers from Galesburg.
Ms. Knight, yes. I'm going to start you right out.
Yes.
Using the court's logic, could a defendant ever win a coercion claim? Because the court seemed to find that she was either lying when she confessed or she was lying when she said she was coerced. Now, that would be true, I would think, in every case of coercion, that a defendant's story changes. It changes. And it seems to me to be just circular thinking on the part of the court.
Okay, now we're talking about the underlying criminal trial court.
Yeah.
And we have the transcript, we have the order. The court did say that. And, yes, I have to concede
it's
that...
It's completely goofy.
I don't know that I would say it's goofy, goofy, but obviously, in a coerced confession case...
Well, I don't
case,
understand. It's completely goofy. How can you give collateral estoppel effect to such irrational judicial thinking? I mean, it's great implications, right? Suppose someone admitted that he'd committed perjury. And then the judge would say, oh, well, I can't credit your admission because you were either lying then or you're lying now, so you're completely incredible.
Well, because as Judge McDade pointed out, there was a 2 full days of hearing. The witnesses testified. The criminal trial judge was making the assessment of credibility of those witnesses.
Look, suppose you had an orangutan sitting in the judge's chair, and he's an intelligent monkey, and he makes several good comments, right? And then he makes this goofy comment about, if you lied when you confessed, then I can't believe you when you said you were lying, right? Well, we would say this party had not received a full and fair hearing, because even though there were moments of rationality by the trier of fact, they were only intermittent, right? So I just don't understand how this judge can be taken seriously.
Because he was in the position of assessing the credibility of everybody that was there.
Yeah, but the basis on which he assessed it was irrational. That is, if you say, I can't believe you when you say your confession was false, because by saying your confession is false, you have conceded that you lied when you confessed, and therefore I can't believe you. So it's not credibility based on, you know, shifty-eyed person or something that might be rational. It's a credibility judgment based on an irrational judgment. So it isn't entitled any weight, it seems to me, in a subsequent proceeding.
I agree that is an irrational statement in his finding. I don't agree that he was not, therefore, otherwise judging the credibility of all these witnesses like he was supposed to.
But you can't go... Look, first...
But I can't go behind it. You're right. I don't know. I wasn't there.
First of all, the judgment of the state court in the suppression hearing wasn't a final. That's not some kind of final judgment by any stretch of the imagination. Teresa was still entitled to raise the issue again before the jury and have the jury decide whether the confession was coerced and false. Secondly, because the charges were dropped, the suppression ruling becomes... unappealable, and collateral estoppel is an equitable doctrine, and in those circumstances it's extremely unfair to hold Teresa to the results of an unappealable ruling. And to me, the collateral estoppel rulings are just unexplainable. So
oh, I'm not sure how to respond to that. It sounds like that's definitive, but... Because, I mean, there are other issues I would talk about if this is...
Well, generally, an unappealable ruling is not given collateral estoppel effect. Is there a reason to make an exception here?
That's not true. That all unappealed rulings can't be given.
No, I said normally, generally, unappealable. I mean, you look at the whole. So the basic standard, you only give collateral estoppel effect. There's been a full and fair opportunity to litigate the issue.
Right. Okay.
Now, if it was on a you have a judge makes a completely irrational ruling which cannot be appealed. Now, if you put those two things together. Isn't it very hard to argue that there was a full and fair adjudication of the issue of the voluntariness of the confession? Why do you defend a case? Look, let me ask you another thing.
All right, could I
in a situation like this, where obviously Galesburg, these people, these defendants, they obviously made a serious mistake, right? They made a serious mistake.
I don't believe the Galesburg defendants made a mistake.
Excuse me?
They didn't
make a mistake?
Oh, because they ultimately had the wrong person.
Yeah, that's a mistake, right?
Yes.
That's a serious mistake.
Yes.
Yeah. In a situation like this, does Galesburg ever offer people compensation? That is, say to them, look, we made a mistake. We don't think there's any liability, but we made a mistake. You were jailed wrongfully. You were jailed mistakenly, and therefore we're going to give you compensation, not because we think it's a legal duty, but because we made a mistake and you suffered without cause, and therefore we're going to give you compensation. Is that ever done? Is that permissible?
Well, Your Honor, I don't represent Galesburg, so I'm not going to answer for them in that regard.
Okay.
But I will say, since the question's come up, I think I should fairly say that a very significant offer was made to these plaintiffs in the media in the Seventh Circuit conference room here.
No, that's too late. That's much too late. I'm not talking about offers and compromise of litigation. I'm saying before there's any lawsuit, at some point you discover you have the wrong people. They've been rotting in jail, right? At that point, before there's a lawsuit, is there a practice? But you may be the wrong person. I'm sorry. I mean, I didn't realize you weren't representing. You're not representing Galesburg or Knoxville. Yeah,
I represent Chief PC, and
right.
We did a joint brief.
But do you know whether any of these cities have a practice of offering compensation in advance of litigation, simply in acknowledgement of the mistake, to head off this kind of thing?
Well, I think you asked me once in a past false arrest case why my officer didn't apologize to someone, and this kind of reminds me of the same type of question. Do I know if Knoxville or Galesburg has that policy? I don't know. Mr. Kelly might know about Galesburg.
Okay.
Well, if I could...
Want to reserve your time or something you'd like?
No, could I just say
oh,
one...
Oh, you don't have... You're right. Wrong.
Right, I don't... And I'm splitting with Mr. Kelly.
Yeah,
if I could
ahead.
Just say one thing Take about time. The Chavez case in the Fifth Amendment, this confession was not used under Chavez. This confession was not used under the Third Circuit case that we cited, Renda versus King.
Ms. Knight,
plaintiff has not cited any cases. Yes.
Forgive me, but the plaintiffs rather helpfully pointed out that Teresa's confession was in fact used against her to force a plea on a rather odd obstruction charge, and that, it seems to me, would eviscerate any Chavez argument that the confession wasn't used in a criminal case, not to mention the fact that it was used to hold her in jail for the 4 months pending trial. So I had a lot of trouble with the Chavez argument.
Okay. Because in Chavez, he was not charged. But, Your Honor, in Chavez, the Supreme Court said the Fifth Amendment right is a fundamental trial right, spelled out T-R-I-A-L. And they went back to their Winthrow case. Winthrow said a constitutional violation occurs only at trial. I know this court has never addressed the issue, but in the court also explained that the Fifth Amendment prophylactic rights of Miranda and invoking the right at administrative hearings is only prophylactic, but the actual constitutional right does not take place till it's introduced at trial. It wasn't in this case. Plaintiff cites no case to the contrary. Judge Easterbrook's opinion since Chavez and Allison versus Snyder addressed the Chavez case, not on our point, but
so
said it's when it's used
remedy?
At trial.
So what is the remedy? I mean, suppose you have a confession beaten out of you and you're put in jail for 6 months and then without a trial or anything, and then it's dropped at the end. Is there a remedy?
If the court would believe that there's a substantive due process remedy in that setting.
I'm asking you a question. Is there a remedy?
No.
There's no federal constitutional remedy? That's a surprising suggestion.
Some Supreme Court judges have authored that there would be under substantive due process, but it's not clear. Because this is not Lewis, it's not a hot pursuit, it's not Rochin, there's no physical abuse in this case.
It's not denying a person liberty without due process of law? Depriving a person of liberty without due process of law? No?
If we're talking about the coerced confession, which is what pleaded in this case, it's either got to be the Fifth Amendment or substantive due process.
You beat up a person, get a confession, on the basis of the confession,
right,
charge him, put him in jail, but you never actually prosecute him. And you're saying that that's not a deprivation of liberty without due process of law.
No. Probably Albright or one of those.
Excuse
cases.
Me?
I was thinking probably Albright right now, but on a malicious prosecution theory.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Knight. Mr. Kelly?
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Jim Kelly on behalf of the City of Galesburg and Defendants Clay.
So maybe you can answer my question. Do these cities, when they make a mistake in jailing people, ever compensate them without waiting to be sued?
Judge, I can say with regard to my client, the City of Galesburg, I'm not aware that they've ever wrongfully jailed anyone prior to this, so I don't think there's any precedent
please,
on that. But
please.
But on the issue of offering money to people for other things, slip and fall on a sidewalk, whatever it may be, it's frequently done. It's frequently done to say, we're sorry this happened, we'll pay an emergency room bill, we'll give you some money. That happens frequently. And I've dealt with this client for a long time, and they do that quite regularly.
It's pretty scary, isn't it, that if you slip and fall, they'll say, I'm sorry. But if they coerce a confession out of you and they put you in a jail cell for 4 months, and when they let you out, they say to you, well, now we're going to charge you with obstruction, you know, that they might not. That's pretty scary,
Judge,
stuff.
My client has no ability to try them for or charge them for obstruction of justice. That's the state's attorney that did that. In fact, the state's attorney said that in his deposition that he, beyond a reasonable doubt, could convict these people of this robbery. And in fact, there's been a jailhouse confession from somebody else, but there's never been a charge on this bank robbery by anybody else. It took 6 months for the FBI and I implore you to look at those photographs. As Judge Posner said, they're like twins. The evidence in this case is the type of, it's so strong that it's the type of thing you'll be talking about at a cocktail party, that maybe they did this. It was so strong. This very morning, these people talked about, how do we get out of our financial woes? They made a call to a credit counseling agency.
Are you suggesting they are actually the robbers?
I'm suggesting that these officers acted in good faith.
I thought you were suggesting they might actually be the robbers, and the person who confessed was maybe that was a false confession. Is that what
Your Honor, it's a person sitting in a federal penitentiary that the best he could say is, I robbed some banks up and down Interstate 74. That's all they have. And as you know from people sitting in jail, they like to take credit.
But when you study these pictures, it's clear they're different people.
Well, Your Honor, the FBI had these photos for months.
No, but you just look at them. You know they're different people.
I think it's uncanny, Judge, how...
No, they do look like twins, but they don't look like identical twins. They look different. They're not the same person.
For purposes... And I'm not... We're not here...
You really think they're the same people?
Judge, what I'm saying is that when these officers, starting with the bankrupt.
I understand that they could make a reasonable mistake, but I don't understand you're actually believing that they are the same person.
I'm not, Judge. I'm not saying that. What I'm trying to do is focus on the issues that are on this appeal, and that is how these officers acted. We have the benefit of hindsight, 2020, and the cases say that's not what you're supposed to do. And if you look at this case, and you look at what these officers had to deal with, how amazing is it that somebody in a bank robbery actually says, that looks like somebody that comes into this bank. That information became known. Their account was closed or had a zero balance. They go to his place of employment. He's parked sideways in a parking spot that he knows he's never supposed to park in. He admits to being in the scene.
What about Mr. Kanovitz's argument that this fellow Duggan withdrew his identification?
My argument to that is, judges, there is enough overwhelming other evidence, and that if somebody ran in here right now and ran back out, every one of us would have. We're fighting over punctilios about the eyewitness account. The rest of the evidence is so strong on probable cause.
The pictures, really.
It's not just the pictures. It's the fact that he admitted to being in the scene of the robbery on the day in question. It's the fact that he admitted to having a motive, a financial difficulty. It's the fact when my officers went out and investigated, they said that he made statements to the McDonald's drive-thru. He made a statement to his employer, they must be coming to talk to me about the robbery. His wife, the neighbor, testified that his wife acted strangely. She usually waves and said hello. She nervously went in the house. There's a number of things that showed probable cause. And with regard to my officers, your point, Judge, was the bystander liability. Judge McDade got it right. My officers had no personal involvement. Galesburg had no personal involvement in getting, first of all, with regard to Scott Sorenberger. They didn't arrest him. They didn't do anything with his booking. So they had no personal involvement, no 1983 liability. The creative bystander theory, Yang says, could a reasonable officer have intervened?
Well, who were the officers who threatened to take the kids away?
Your Honor, the undisputed evidence in this case is that my two officers, Shepard and Riley, brought Mrs. Sorenberger down to the station to question her, like she had been the night before, and there is no evidence they said anything other than, "Ma'am, we're arresting your husband. You can't protect. You can't think about him anymore. Think about your family and your kids." That's the only evidence we have up until that first confession. How could a reasonable officer, judge, to hit on your point about immunity, how could a reasonable officer think that he's violating the law by saying that? That's what the undisputed evidence is up until the time she gives that first confession.
It's pretty obvious he's threatening to take the kids away.
Your Honor, one of the officers didn't even know she had kids. They went in and...
Well, now, someone who said to her, you should be thinking about... Oh, you think when...
Riley says in his deposition, "I didn't even know he had kids. I took it the way the officer said it. You got to think about your family. Think about yourself now." Nobody in their wildest dreams thought this lady was going to confess to being the getaway driver. This confession, this whole process took less than 2 hours. She was brought down. She wasn't handcuffed. She says right in her testimony, "I voluntarily agreed to go down there. Nobody ever told me I was a suspect." And within a short period of time, after seeing these photographs, she starts to cry. And they ask her, tell me what you know. They didn't ask her pointed questions. They didn't take a murder weapon and set it out there. She told a story, a narrative story.
How definitive is the FBI's scientific elimination of Scott?
We asked them that question, and they couldn't give us like DNA, any percentages, or anything like that. That is the only evidence, and it came months later, that this FBI enhancement of the ear that they did. They couldn't give us figures. I asked that question. I wanted to know that same question because it goes back to Judge Posner's question about these officers sitting there scratching their head. We had all this evidence. This lady gave a confession, a free-flowing narrative confession, saying she was the getaway driver. There's nothing inconsistent about that. All the evidence we have looking back was consistent with this lady doing this. These officers were as startled as anybody was when she said, "I drove the getaway car."
I take it it's still in... your part of the world and impenetrable as to whether or not it was Duggan or if it was the Sorenbergers.
You mean in terms of who robbed the bank? Judge, I think the officers have had all this evidence, and if you look at our brief, we have the list of all the people who saw these photographs and all the people who were involved in this meetings. Keep in mind, my officers came for a very limited purpose the next day to do some investigation, and they thought that they had good, strong evidence of probable cause and that they were the bank robbers. And it's unfortunate. What happened is very unfortunate. But this, we have to look at it, what these officers were looking at back at that time, and the evidence was strong.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kelly. Mr. Kanovitz, you have anything further?
The first point I'd like to make is the recitation of the undisputed facts that Mr. Kelly just gave are the facts according to his client, according to Shepard, according to Riley. That is not the story that Ms. Sorenberger tells of what happened in that room. You know, according to Ms. Sorenberger, once they got me into the room, they told me my husband was going to be arrested. They told me I was suspected of this crime. They told me it could have an adverse effect on my family. They said, think about yourself and your kids. I kept saying, this is Ms. Sorenberger's words, I kept telling them, that's not him in the picture. She said he didn't even own a baseball cap that looks like that. You know, and they pressed her, and they pressed her and pressed her, pressed her. And finally they said, I'm sick and tired of this. I'm going to go call DCFS. That is the facts that have to be taken as established for purposes of summary judgment, and that is a perfectly fit example of you get what you ask for from Shepard, because he coerced her until she said, okay, I'll tell you a story, I did it, don't take away my kids. I'd like to come back to the qualified immunity point, not to rehash the discussion that you and I had, Your Honor, but to make a point that there is also a waiver issue on qualified immunity as it applies to PC, who's the actual person that made the formal arrest of Scott Sorenberger. And that was a issue that the district court passed on because, the district court decided I don't even have to go any further because there was, probable cause as a matter of law. Which
I understand that you didn't concede that heard the retraction. Didn't hear the retraction. I understand that you didn't concede that. But if he didn't hear the retraction, how would that change his liability?
I don't believe it would change it at all, because the statement by Dugan and the retraction are just a small step that points the investigation in a direction. It's a statement about evidence that PC had in his hand. It's a statement about the picture. And PC then obtains pictures of Scott Sorenberger. PC then obtains a live view of Scott Sorenberger. PC can make up his own mind about the degree of resemblance.
Yeah, but we've got two people that look like twins. Almost identical twins.
For a while, it's my understanding, this is outside of the record, but for a while, the spank...
Nothing outside the record. Don't clutter my mind. It's so cluttered.
People often look alike. People may even bear a strong resemblance. And a strong resemblance may yield a reasonable suspicion to follow up a little bit. But, there are differences there if you want to see them. And probable cause asks about what was reasonable under the circumstances.
I know, but when you put all these facts together, as Mr. Kelly so ably did, you really have a basis for a reasonable belief that, indeed, this is the fellow, plus a picture that is so close.
Our primary pieces of evidence on probable cause are the teller's description and the pictures, and then there's some other evidence that Mr. Kelly was talking about, but there's evidence also going the other way. I mean, you've got, yes, they were having financial problems. You've got both of them employed at steady jobs. You've got the Sorenbergers being longstanding members of the community. You've got the fact that this was a bank robbery committed by an unmasked man, which... unless somebody wants to get caught, they don't walk into their own bank without a mask. Maybe it's a fact that cuts both
wrong.
Ways.
Oh, how wrong you are. 21 years of doing bank robberies, you're wrong. Yes, they do.
Well, and also, there's the fact that these people have no criminal record. To the extent that there's smaller facts that figure in, there's facts going both ways. And the real two competing facts are the pictures and the degree of resemblance and the teller's description, which can't be Scott. So to that extent, I don't think that Mr. Dugan's statement about his feeling that the picture resembled Scott, or his retraction for that matter, figure in very much, because it's really the emphasis is on the officers having the ability to make up their own minds on that, because they had pictures of Scott, they had the live view of Scott. If that is an answer to your question, I hope.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. And thank you to Mr. Kelly and Ms. Knight. Next case for our